Hi everyone, this is the podcast for the Orfila Center's Structural Violence, Police and Prison Abolition and Decoloniality Research Cluster. In this series, we feature the compelling works of different scholars and activists whose research touches upon violence, marginalization, and carcerality. Today, we will be talking to Mina Ibrahim. Ibrahim is completing his PhD in Cultural Studies at the University of Gießen. His dissertation, Coptic Misfits in the Shadow of Altars, Domes, and Street Protests, investigates politically, socially, and theologically negated spaces and practices among Coptic Christians in Egypt. He is also project coordinator of the MENA Prison Forum and the founding director of Shobra's Archive. His recent publications include articles with Social Compass, Endowment Studies, and Middle East Topics and Arguments. Thank you so much, Mina, for agreeing to speak with us and to be part of this podcast. To start, I wanted to ask you if you can tell us a little bit about yourself and your research interests and trajectory. Why are you interested in carcerality in the Middle East? I know your research also focuses in part on policing practices in Egypt, mostly from the point of view of studying everyday religiosity. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Gehet, for having me. First of all, my research interests actually started mainly in 2017 with my PhD fieldwork. I started my fieldwork at bar actually in Cairo, which is owned by a Coptic Christian, which actually gave me the idea to start navigating spaces that are overlooked when studying a religious minority like Coptic Christians. So that was the first space where I did my field work. Later on, I started to see other spaces, similar spaces. So one of them, including the prisons, that's why I started as well to focus on carcerality and histories and cultures of incarceration, which, of course, interest that I had since 2016, but increased also when I joined to work with the MENA Prison Forum, a project, a regional interdisciplinary project that is based in Beirut. And then I started to navigate prisons, bars, casinos, nightclubs, week gatherings, even to look into spaces, queer spaces as well, spaces, safe spaces for queer Copts as well in Cairo and in Egypt. So all of these spaces give me the idea is to think broadly about religious minorities beyond the idea of representing their, between brackets, perfect religious identity or perfect religious faith. So to get back to my interest in carcerality, it's not all about political prisoners, as people usually focus on, but also criminal prisoners as well. Of course, in a country like Egypt or in the MENA region, criminal and political prisoners are usually like mixed, and they usually live together, you know, in the same cell. But for me, I focused also on criminal prisoners because, again, you know, they give us more ideas about how prisons are central to the governments, not only in Egypt, but also in the wider region.
Thank you so much. The second question is kind of similar. I wanted to ask you about how, I know you've been doing research since your BA and you did an MA, so you've been doing research for a long time. So I wanted to ask you about your scholarly background more generally, like how has your BA and like MA research experiences guided your steps towards your current project? And why did you decide to tackle these research themes? You do anthropology or like doing ethnography?
Yeah, so I started my BA, actually the beginning was with political science after I joined the university in 2009, 2010. But then later after the revolution in 2011, I started to, as many people actually of my generation at the American University in Cairo, where I did my BA, we started to look into anthropology as a discipline, which can give us more, get us closer to the people, right? So political science is usually taught as a discipline of institutions, of, you know, international relations, international law, but people are absent in a way. But with anthropology and sociology, you have the chance to get closer to the people. So I started to be interested in anthropology. I did a minor during my BA. I also wrote also my master's thesis also in anthropology. about Coptic Christians, and mainly it was about Coptic Christians and the 2011 revolution and uprisings. But then later, you know, and while doing my PhD, it was like 6 years later or something like that, I started to look into Coptic Christians beyond the revolution. So beyond means that after and before as well. And to look at them as well, beyond as well the street protests. Because, you know, like Copts usually are made visible to the Western communities when they, for example, when they get attacked through a church bombing or through, I don't know, a sectarian intentions, to have, like sectarian intentions that make them visible to the Western community, or when they join street protests during demonstrations. But then I started to look at them into more invisible spaces.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Mina. So speaking of ethnography and fieldwork, can you share with us an interesting story or part of your research pertaining to imprisonment and carcerality in the Middle East? Maybe an encounter from your research on Coptic invisibility, or anything you came across that may have broken certain perceptions that you had or that you learned from?
Yeah, of course. Like the for example, the opening vignette of the seventh chapter of my dissertation is about a guy called Magdi Essa, who was like a criminal, right? He killed two people. He also was executed in November 1958. But then, you know, like he got executed because actually, according to the Coptic Christian tradition, Mary appeared to him in prison and actually asked him to confess, you know, not only to his priest, but also to the court. So he had confession, you know, took two levels. And then he confessed not only about what he did, but also about what his partner in crime did. So then, you know, many years later, the church, Coptic church, celebrated him, you know, as a guy who got repented, you know, and then Mary appeared to him, you know, and then, you know, they also, like, yeah, they connected him, you know, to the image of Jesus on the cross, you know, when the thief next to him, you know, also repented a few, like, minutes before he died as well. And, yeah, and according to the church, he's not a saint, of course, but he is a good guy who surely went to heaven, you know, into heaven after he died. So that's the opening vignette. The closing vignette of the chapter is about this monk who was accused of killing a bishop in 2018. An incident took place in one of the monasteries in Egypt, a Coptic monastery. And two monks were accused of killing a bishop. And one of them actually was executed also last year. And the other one got 25 life sentence, 25 years. But then, after the monk was executed, one of them was executed, Pope Tawadros was asked during a sermon, can we consider this monk was executed a martyr? He said, no, of course he's not a martyr, he's a criminal. Although, like, according to the Coptic church tradition and history, you know, there are a lot of people who are criminals, but they repented before they die, and we know that they can go to heaven, you know. But for the Pope, because, of course, this case, it happened today, he was executed by the state. The monk himself, you know, actually said that, or his lawyer said that he cannot, the monk was forced to confess of what he did, and that he was tortured as well to confess. But whether the monk killed the bishop or not, you know, I really got shocked actually between this comparison, or between a guy who was a criminal as well, and then celebrated in the church, but then this monk who actually got executed without any even being offered a chance to repent, or even offered a chance to be labeled as a martyr, or as a saint, or as even a good guy, or even as a repented, you know, criminal.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's really interesting, like, that you put these two vignettes together, and that there's a historical and like an ethnographic kind of method to your research. So I know that you also, through your work with the MENA Prison Forum and the center, the Shobra Archive Center that you founded here in Shobra, I think because of that, your research kind of goes beyond the bounds of the university. And I wanted to ask if you could tell us a little bit more about your work with MPF and then later SERD, your center in Shobra, and kind of the story of how you founded it. And finally, I wanted to ask if you view this work as a form of scholarly activism.
Okay, so for the MENA Prison Forum, the MPF, I joined it during its first days in September 2018, when late Lebanese scholar, publisher and filmmaker Luqman Sleem and his partner journalist and filmmaker Monica Borgman invited me to join their initiative, which is part of Oman Documentation and Research. And actually, my interest in joining the MENA Prison Forum is twofold. Actually, I'm interested, again, as I mentioned, into the how prisons are integral methods of ruling, you know, for governments in the MENA region. But on the other hand, the exceptional thing really about the MENA Prison Forum, that we are also interested in archiving prisons, to build archives for prisons. Archives through movies, books, novels, I mean books, academic and non-academic, but also art, work, official reports written by governmental agencies. So building an archive for prisons is key, you know, for us in our work, in order to give, you know, a platform for activists, researchers, and artists to come together and to learn from each other's work. So we figured out that art only is not enough to investigate prisons. Academia also is not enough, and also activism is not enough. But their different languages should come together in a forum, and that's why it's called the MENA Prison Forum, right? To speak to each other. That's for the MENA Prison Forum. For Shobra's Archive, it's actually the same, you know, like Shobra's Archive, the idea also started during my fieldwork in Shobra, right? I, 2019, I wrote a couple of articles for academic journals based in Europe. But then I figured out, okay, like these articles would be read, if any, by some people, you know, few scholars who might want to cite it in a way or another, or criticize it, or, you know, whatever. But then, you know, there is no kind of response to it on the field, you know. So I thought that this dilemma actually is actually connected to a scene in academia in general. Like Shobra, for example, where Shobra's archive is based, and a neighborhood in Cairo. Shobra is located and, you know, it's a kind of a research lab, you know, for many ethnographers and anthropologists, you know, people who do field work. So they contribute to the knowledge production, you know, in academic articles and books. But when it comes to how this knowledge is later circulated, it's absent. You know, we don't have any place in Shobra that can reflect, for example, Asif Bayat's chapter about Shobra in his book, you know, Life as Politics. We don't have a chapter, for example, we don't have a place in Zawiya al-Hamra, you know, that can reflect Farha Ghannam's book, books about Zawiya al-Hamra. It's not that I'm criticizing, you know, that this works, but that the idea that people in these spaces need to have, you know, to respond, need to be connected to these works in a way or another, you know, in any way, but they need really to connect to them. So the idea of Shobra's archive really is to build this bridge, you know, to extend the role of the neighborhoods beyond the knowledge production phase, to extend it to other phases of also to the circulation of this knowledge after the works are getting published.
Yes, I think that's really amazing work, and I think even since you started the Shobra's Archive, I feel like it's come a long way and you've been doing really interesting work. And can you tell us about how that experience has been, kind of working with young researchers?
So last year, actually, I started actually in the middle, you know, of building Shobra's Archive. I really thought that it won't work alone, you know, like I cannot work in this thing alone. So I drafted a call for contributions, you know, for people who, researchers, who are interested in oral history and archives in general, or who want to learn about them. Because for myself, I'm not that also expert in archiving, you know. But let's gather together and start to learn from each other. So I did this call. We had like around 48 applications. We got like, okay, we accepted 21. And then we started a program. We called it a learning research program. But we really started in May 2021 with some, you know, master classes about oral history, family history, personal history, ethnography, digital humanities, digital archiving, all of this, you know, all of like this package. And then later in August, we started to think, okay, let's do a project. together. Let's build something together. You know, we, because for me, there should be something practical. You know, I'm not into just, you know, learning, but really we should put things into practice, you know, and to try things on ground. So we went to work on Cairo tramlines to historicize and to archive Cairo tramways. We chose the trams for two reasons. We are based in Shubra, and we are called Shubra's Archive, but we don't want to turn Shubra into an, you know, isolated island. You know, we also want to connect it to other neighborhoods in Cairo, and that's why we connected. The tram lines are really good into telling us stories about Shubra through its connections with other districts in Cairo. And the other reason as well, that the researchers we have in the space, they have different, you know, backgrounds. So some of them are interested in literature, some of them are interested in history, some of them are interested in anthropology. So we, and that's why the project of archiving Cairo's tramways, we called it Salam Tram. We actually worked on three pillars. We worked with documents, you know, that could be dated back to the early years of the tram company, the Belgian company, which was came to Cairo in 1896, I think. And then we also worked on newspapers, novels, you know, that cover stories about Cairo's tramways during the 50s, 40s, 60s of the 20th century. And then also we conducted oral history interviews that in a way covered the last days of the tram, you know, that people's memories with the trams before their before they left Cairo, before they were removed, you know, that the tram tracks before they were removed, 2017, 2018. So we covered the three periods, the beginning, the middle, and the end, through these different methods. And also to give the chance for the different backgrounds of the researchers to, you know, to be visible or to be in news.
Thank you. My second question is about, we know that through MPF, you designed an amazing syllabus on carcerality in the Middle East. That was a very powerful guiding point for the Orfila Center's research cluster, for our research cluster. Can you tell us about your thought process in the creation of that syllabus? And what were you really keen on adding to that syllabus? How did you think about connecting the readings together? Finally, I know you also taught a class using the syllabus, or at least parts of it. So can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, drafting the syllabus was part of the MENA Prison Forum's work, which is connecting art, academia, and activism together. So I taught this class in Marburg University in last year. And the syllabus actually is based on, it's divided into themes. For example, you take gender and prisons as a theme, and then you start to add these items, a film, a novel, artwork. You also have an academic reading, you know, connected to it. You also have a story of a prisoner. You also have a story of an activist, you know. You have music as well, you know, connected to this theme. You so integrate art into the academic syllabus. During teaching the course, or while teaching the course also, I invited artists, I invited activists, I invited academics as well, who are working into this, into the theme or the topic of prisons, to give talks to the students in the class. So really the idea was to, as much as I can, you know, to really give the chance to the students to think beyond their academic readings, you know, which are more, push them to theorize, push them to think in an abstract way, in a way. Because, you know, topics like prisons and incarceration, really, for me, in my opinion, the last thing we should do is to theorize, you know, for me, like, the most important thing really is to try to make sense, actually, at the beginning of what's going on. And then we start, maybe we later we can theorize, but you cannot theorize something without even understanding it. And for me, prisons in the MENA region is a big mystery, and many things we don't know, many things we don't understand. You have a lot of practices happening that really you would never believe it, even if you hear it from the survivor of torture or of incarceration. We need really further to understand what prisons are in order to theorize them.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So in terms of like putting the readings together for the syllabus and writing your dissertation, I wanted to ask you What are some of the most inspiring pieces of writing or books that guided some of your work? For example, what are some works that you feel are a must read for people thinking about decoloniality, structural violence, and police and prison abolition?
Like, for me, decolonizing even knowledge production in general about prisons, mm-hmm. in particular, there is this amazing book by Yasin Haq Saleh called Representations of Representation of Horror, or Horror and Its Representation. I'm translating it from Arabic, okay, which is a must read for people. I think it's in Arabic, but I think it will be soon translated in English. Which is a must read, you know, because Yasin Haq Saleh, of course, is a well-known writer and activist, you know, Syrian activist and writer. And really, in his work, he is really grappling with, you know, the language of, or the human rights language of Amnesty International or of Human Rights Watch. And he's trying to say, to provide more, you know, vernacular and local, you know, languages and terms to represent, you know, the horror of the Syrian prisons. Or of prisons in general. So really, that's I would recommend this a lot. For another book as well, I don't know, I don't want to be biased for the MENA Prison Forum, but on our website, really, we have a lot of small logs written by activists, researchers, and former prisoners as well, artists as well, who wrote these small logs, you know. They are available in English, but with English also abstracts, if you may check the website. Also, you have really very kind of nuanced, you know, narratives about prisons in the MENA region. You know, things really that you would not find in, you know, in very kind of, you know, academic books, if you want to call them. But yeah, like, sadly, really, you know, that the production of knowledge about prisons in the MENA region is not too much. We need more. We need really more books about the topic. There are recently, of course, the work also of like Hannah Sisi. She wrote her PhD doctoral dissertation also about prisons during the 50s and 60s in Egypt. I'm sure it's amazing. When it's coming out as a book, it will be amazing. But we really need to use even local terms. So, for example, I have a friend of mine, a Syrian friend, Jaber Bakr. He's a writer and activist as well. He would always push me and push also our friends to use the word sigin, you know, instead of prisons. Because for him, sigin or mu'taqal, you know, they should be used in the English dictionary, not the prisons, because for him, prisons are, when we say Syrian prisons or Egyptian prisons, we always recall prisons in the Western countries, you know. Mm-hmm. But for him, no, these places of incarceration, if you want, sigin or mu'taqal, should be given, like, you know, like, yeah, they should be kind of different. They should be treated as different from the prisons as a word.
That's very interesting. I've never thought about it that way, so I think that's really interesting. So finally, is there anything else that you would like to add? Is there something I haven't asked you about that you would like to say that's important for thinking through carcerality and imprisonment in the region? And do you have any side projects, for example, that you're currently working on that you'd like to share? Anything you'd like to add that I missed?
No, thanks a lot. I recently really was like Shobra's archive, but also with the MENA Prison Forum, like in general, trying really to give, you know, also together with my colleagues in Shobra's archive or at the MENA Prison Forum, try to give more importance to oral history and to oral narratives and to documenting these narratives. Not only so for the MENA Prison Forum, of course, about prison experiences, and for Shobra's archive, more about local histories of neighborhoods and districts in and outside Cairo. Because I think, you know, these narratives, you know, in Egypt or in the region, MENA region in general, we have like an unfortunate scene for archiving. Like, we don't have really... We don't have really an understanding for what archives mean. You know, archives are just for the state, or they are monopolized by the state in general. So really to democratize, you know, the production of archives, to democratize also the production or the methods of documentation is very important on different levels and for different topics as well.
Thank you so much, Mina, for your time. I learned so much from this conversation right now. Thank you for being so generous with your knowledge.
Thanks a lot.